Welcome to the Federal Societies Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Societies Corporation, Securities and Antitrust, and International Law, National Security Law Practice Groups, was recorded on Wednesday, February 28, 2018, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call, as today we consider the CFIUS and Trump administration action on the attempted takeover of Qualcomm by Broadcom. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future and will very likely be transcribed. We're very pleased to welcome two return guests to Teleforum today. Stuart Baker is a partner at Steptoe & Johnson. He's also the author of Skating on Stilts, a book that deals at least in part with today's topic. Skating on Stilts is available on Amazon.com and other booksellers everywhere. He'll give us opening remarks of about 10 minutes, followed by John Hsu. He's an attorney and legal commentator who will also give us about 10 minutes of opening remarks. We're going to hear first generally on CFIUS and then more about this decision and action in particular. But as always, we'll be looking to the audience for your questions, so please have those in mind for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Stuart Baker, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you. CFIUS, as we call it, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, is an institution that has been around since the 1970s. It was legislatively blessed in the 1980s as the Exxon Florio Act, and it's a response to a gradual globalization of the U.S. economy in a series of waves of foreign investment that have sparked unease and policy concern as they've occurred. In the 1980s, it was Japanese investment, the Rockefeller Center, much of California, golf courses were purchased by Japanese investors, and the U.S. Expressed its concern about its role in the world by intensifying its review of foreign investments in the most legitimate context the most ordinary context, a review of inward investment to determine whether the investments might have an impact on the national security of the United States. And the most obvious examples of investments that could raise those concerns are when a foreign company buys a U.S. military contractor or a domestic civilian company whose production is nonetheless extraordinarily important for U.S. performance in the event of a military emergency. CFIUS exists to review transactions in which foreign companies acquire control over U.S. Companies to examine whether the transaction might have national security implications. The act has been shaped first by the concerns about Japanese investment in the 80s, and then again, and this is what I talk about in Skating on Stilts, after 9/11, there was an investment in U.S. port facilities by Dubai Port World, which was, as it sounds, a Dubai organization, and considerable political angst was expressed about having a Mideast Arab country acquire access to our ports, where port security was a major concern. It created a giant flap, which I still have the scars from, and I tell the story of the event in the book. In the end, that resulted in changes in legislation, which we are operating under today, relatively modest, but they did, the legislation did institutionalize one of the innovations from earlier years, and that is the creation of mitigation agreements in which investors are allowed to invest but make promises about future behavior that address the national security concerns that have come up in the course of the investigation. The institution itself is most interesting because it's not a an agency on its own to a very substantial degree. It is an interagency process in which different agencies come to the table with a very different set of perspectives, so that traditionally the USTR and the State Department come to express views favorable to foreign investment, and DOD and DHS and DOJ come bearing considerable skepticism about foreign investment and its impact on their mission to protect the United States. And the interagency process essentially works through those disagreements in the way that interagency processes always do, which is by steadily escalating debate until it reaches the cabinet secretaries in very serious debates. The organization is chaired by the Treasury Department rather than by the traditional White House and National Security Council or National Economic Council principles, but it functions in many respects like those institutions. Treasury has become more institutional recently, taking a larger role in negotiating and in ruling on how to approach particular transactions. So that's the background. What has happened in the last year is we are now in another wave of anxiety about foreign investment, particularly Chinese investment, and we have an administration that resonates to that anxiety to a degree we haven't seen in many years. And as a result, the committee has taken much more aggressive action to say no to a wide variety of transactions, particularly those involving China in one way or another. That sets, I think, the scene for the Broadcom-Qualcomm fight, which will draw on many of these themes. I guess before I do that, before I hand it over to John to talk about that, I will say the other development that has shaped this environment is that a Chinese investor that wanted to acquire some wind farm property ran into considerable, this is the Rawls case, ran into considerable difficulty with CFIUS under the last administration. And rather than quietly accepting the determination that the company could not acquire a U.S. set of properties that included properties close to military bases, Rawls went to court and challenged the decision, refusing to allow the transaction to be maintained. And won on the grounds that they had not been given procedural due process. As a result of that, Treasury's lawyers and the committee in general have reshaped their internal processes to make sure that they will never again be successfully accused of failing to grant procedural due process, while, if anything, making it more likely that they will, on substance, say no to the transaction. So that is where things stood when Broadcom decided to make a hostile tender for Qualcomm. John?
Thank you, Stuart. And for those who are unfamiliar with Stuart's book, you should note that it's a 5-star review on Amazon.com, so it's worth the money.
It's a policy book you can take to the beach.
Stuart deserves a lot of credit, you know, for incorporating DHS into CFIUS in 75 when President Ford essentially created it, and then in 88 when Congress codified it. There was no Homeland Security at the time, and of course Homeland Security now is an important part of the committee. So for those of you who are not completely familiar with this deal, what happened was, in short, in the fall, Broadcom, which was a chip maker, originally based here in Irvine, California, but eventually bought out by an entity in Singapore, decided to make a hostile takeover offer for Qualcomm, which is America's number one 5G chip maker and 5G company. And Qualcomm is based also here in San Diego, California. And 5G is a very important technology. It's the next step in cellular technology. For those who would think about how do you control your car or your house temperature or whatever, that's all 5G. And 5G is very important, not just for the civilian side, but also for the military side. And Qualcomm does have a lot of contracts and agreements with the United States government in various capacities. The head of Broadcom in Singapore, he's a U.S. citizen, Mr. Tan, and he lobbied very heavily. He and the company lobbied very heavily through O'Melveny and Myers and other groups. He even came to the White House in November of 2017, met with President Trump. They had a press conference together, and that was to approve Broadcom's buyout of Brocade Communications, which is another chip maker, that one based in San Jose. And there, Mr. Tan announced that Broadcom was going to re-domicile from Singapore to the United States. Now, the reason that's important for the Broadcom-Qualcomm deal is because the law requires looking at a foreign entity. And I guess the Broadcom view was that if they were domiciled in the United States, they would no longer be considered a foreign entity and then and therefore be out of CFIUS review. But, of course, that didn't happen. And both companies, you know, got their lobbying and engines going. There was a lot of congressional pushback on the deal, Republicans and Democrats, and not just California Republicans. Senator Cornyn from Texas and Senator Cotton from Arkansas also were raising questions about the deal and strongly recommending CFIUS review. I would say Cornyn in particular is important because last year Senator Cornyn and Senator Feinstein co-sponsored a legislation regarding CFIUS and international review. So these were people who were knowledgeable about it, not just local politicians who wanted to keep Qualcomm in San Diego. And so the short of it is, CFIUS made a recommendation to the president to stop it, and he did. And the president's decision to stop a merger, an acquisition, a hostile takeover is not reviewable by the courts. His decision is his decision. And so that was the end of it. Part of the reason, I believe, that the Treasury Department and the committee and the president decided to kill this deal. Number one, the redomiciliation didn't actually occur, and there was no guarantee that it would occur. Number two, CFIUS had specifically instructed all parties to stand down in what they were doing, but Broadcom ignored that. Broadcom, for some unknown reason, they decided to take some significant actions in Singapore. Not in the United States, but in Singapore, to move on their redomiciliation efforts. And third, there were other parties involved, not just Broadcom, Qualcomm. So Broadcom had support from Silver Lake Partners, which is a private equity group, also in Silicon Valley, and also JANA Partners, which is another activist investor group. Both of them have significant ties to foreign entities and foreign monies. And also, both of them have a history of breaking up companies and selling them piece by piece. It's kind of like what Julia Roberts said in Pretty Woman. You steal cars and you sell them for parts. So I think all of that combined convinced the CFIUS and the president that this was a deal that could not go through. The national security implications, especially for the 5G, was just way too serious. Qualcomm is by far and away the number one company in America. And we as a country, we do not want to fall behind, specifically the Chinese or even the Japanese or Korean in the 5G area. So the deal is dead, that's where it is right now.
And if I can just jump in, there are a lot of things that are novel here, or relatively novel. It was always assumed that CFIUS filings were a voluntary matter. If you didn't want to file, then you didn't file, and you took your chances that maybe at some point someone would decide there was a national security problem with your transaction. But the idea that it was voluntary was fundamental to the early years of CFIUS. But for a variety of reasons, CFIUS, especially after Dubai Port World, began to take the view that they had ways of making what was supposed to be voluntary more or less mandatory. If they told you you had to file, you either filed or they filed for you and began the investigation on their own, which was going to have an outcome you wouldn't like. And so as a practical matter now, people have discovered that CFIUS is not a voluntary filing when the government chooses to exercise control. They exercise control here because Qualcomm made a unilateral filing saying, we think we're about to be taken over and we think CFIUS should get involved. This usually, of course, does not happen because these acquisitions are voluntary transactions that both sides support. But in this case, Qualcomm didn't like the transaction and wanted to stop it and decided to bring CFIUS in on the side of incumbent management. And CFIUS accepted that invitation. So that is, while it is not a change from what CFIUS practitioners knew was possible, it was a surprise to a lot of people. The decision was based, what happened is there was an extraordinarily intense 8-day period in which the CFIUS went from having a referred case, a unilaterally referred case, to first saying, okay, we're taking this case. We're going to take interim measures. No one is to take any action that will lead to the change of control or to elect new directors. And we want to make sure that Broadcom doesn't take any action to become an American company until we have resolved this issue. And then within a few days, when Broadcom had taken some actions that seemed to be moving toward becoming an American company, CFIUS said, we have grave national security concerns about this case. You have 24 hours to give us your best case for why we shouldn't block this transaction. And within that 24 hours, the transaction was blocked, and it was blocked on grounds that hadn't been seen much of before. Not, we think that the Chinese are going to take over this company. It was, after all, a Singapore company that had a lot of American ties. But because we think that Broadcom's private equity style of investment will not leave enough money for research and development by Qualcomm. And if it doesn't have enough money for research and development, then it will lose the prominent place that it has in setting 5G standards, and that place will be taken over by companies from China, and that will have an impact on national security, and therefore we are not going to allow a private equity style takeover of Qualcomm. Very granular and not at all focused on the particular character of the buyer, but rather the economic style that the buyer had shown in past transactions. So all of that was new, the rapidity, the style of analysis, the unilateral nature, all of those things combined to make this a highly unusual case.
Very good. Let's open the floor to questions. I have a couple question or two of my own, but let's get the audience queuing up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either or both of our guests, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We'll get to as many questions as possible. We've got almost 40 minutes left. There's a lot on the table here, my first question, would go to Stuart Baker's most recent comment about some of the unique aspects of this series of events. Now, having said all that, what's the reaction in the international community and the public been? Is there anyone contending that this wasn't a warranted finding by CFIUS and action by the President of the United States? I mean, to me, this sort of feels like a modern-day corollary of selling Boeing or some other national security asset when you're talking about chip makers.
Yes and no. Well, first, because Broadcom accepted the outcome, recognizing that it didn't have a lot of options for keeping its campaign alive, the debate has been somewhat muted. And I would say that for those of us in the CFIUS bar, no one thing about this was a surprise. And it is a rare enough occasion that one party opposes a transaction and uses CFIUS to stop it while another party is trying to close the deal, that most of us who practice in front of CFIUS don't expect to see a lot of this. That said, I think there is also a kind of sneaking admiration for how Qualcomm pulled this off. That is to say, they had a proxy fight to name directors that they thought they were going to lose. They found a way to defeat that, the hostile takeover, that was pretty creative, and so Qualcomm's lawyers deserve a lot of credit, and the CFIUS bar is probably thinking to itself, well, that's something I should think about for my clients if I ever need to do it. That does not address the policy issue. I think the policy issue is harder because in a fight of this kind, the defender, the management side of the debate, has a lot of resources they can draw on to do lobbying, and they will draw on them without reserve. And so this turns quickly into a political and a lobbying fight. It's not exclusively that, a lot of the enthusiasm for stopping the transaction has very little to do with national security and a lot to do with other issues that the incumbent management can raise. And so you can easily imagine that decisions like this would be tilted improperly by those political considerations, and that is something we ought to be concerned about. I'm not saying that happened here. I appreciate the determination that was made, but several people have observed that this is a case in which China was the reason that the transaction was rejected, and China is nowhere to be found on either side of the transaction. It's a looming offstage presence, and if it can be the basis for turning down this transaction, it could be the basis for turning down an awful lot of transactions, and that is cause for reflection, at least.
But again, those are transactions limited that involve foreign investment in U.S. companies.
Yes. Although one of the reasons why the why CFIUS acted so quickly, I believe, is they were concerned that they would lose jurisdiction because Broadcom would repatriate itself, point to the fact that it's shareholders were mostly Americans. Its management was pretty heavily American. It was as American as Qualcomm, I'm sure it would have said. And rather than allow that to happen, CFIUS substantially advanced the timetable for making a decision and left Broadcom without any opportunity to do that. It is true if Broadcom had started out as an American company, this would not have been an issue. And it may be that Broadcom, in the course of the Brocade transaction that John mentioned, had created some ill will in CFIUS that helped to explain this outcome. I can't say that for sure.
Well, I want to hear from John Chu on this, and then we'll get to the audience question. And John, as you respond to anything you've heard so far, it's interesting to me that one at least consideration was the idea that the acquiring company had a history of breaking up companies that it had acquired. And you do a lot of banking work, and there's this notion in banking, too big to fail. This almost seems like the inverse of that, where the American interest, the U.S. government interest here, was keeping a big company altogether so that it could continue its business model of research and development. So any response?
Well, the research
issues?
Thank you, Dean. Thank you for that. The research and development part is certainly important. And from a practice perspective, I would say that any entity that's undergoing a merger or acquisition or whatever, we traditionally look at an antitrust view or a Hart-Scott-Rodino view just as a matter of course. And I think now that the world is so interconnected, people should look at a potential CFIUS action just as a matter of course. There have been a number of companies that failed to do that or failed to properly analyze it, stretching all the way back to the 80s, and they've paid the price. I think one mistake that Broadcom did was focus so much on its domicility. I mean, focus so much to the point that they violated the CFIUS order, which is just dumb. And the reason that domicility isn't the only issue that should be analyzed is because, number one, even if it's a U.S. domiciled company, if it's a foreign entity, especially a country like China or Saudi Arabia or whatever, that has control over the group or over the funding, that is enough for a CFIUS review. Number two, imagine this. Imagine that Norinco, which is a huge Chinese defense contractor, that they decide to re-domicile in Kansas. And now all of a sudden they want to buy out Raytheon or General Dynamics or whatever. I mean, there's going to be CFIUS review there, even though it's domiciled now in the United States. And that's because it essentially is a state-owned enterprise. So the domicility factor of it, while it's definitely important, it's not the only one to consider. The other thing that I would point out is, you know, now we're talking about high tech, but Stuart correctly points out that there have been high tech transactions that both Democrats and Republican administrations have either approved in the past, brocade, President Trump approved brocade, or denied. And so it isn't so much a protectionist issue, certainly not in the same sense as steel in the 80s, as it is a national security issue. And that, of course, is where CFIUS comes in. It's for national security. In 2005, when CFIUS essentially blocked CNOOC, which is the Chinese National Petroleum Company, to buy Unocal. Most people don't even remember that Unocal exists now, but Unocal was a huge oil company in the United States. One problem, and you know, CNOOC had hired all kinds of people. They had SCAD and ARPS. They even hired Charlie Black, the Republican consultant. But they couldn't get around the fact that CNOOC is essentially a state-owned enterprise and was receiving, even though their offer was all cash, they had received something like $2.5 billion in cash, interest-free, directly from the Chinese government. That's a big deal. And also, people think of Unocal as primarily an oil company, which it is. But what they didn't realize was, but what CFIUS did, was that Unocal also owned subsidiaries that were involved in rare earth minerals. And that is much more of a national security issue than just straight oil. So you have to look beyond the parties that are just involved. You have to look at the background. You have to look at what other parties are involved, and particularly what other parties may have control. And then you also have to look at what else do the companies own beyond what they're primarily known for. Those are very important factors for practitioners to analyze and to remember.
If I could just add one bit of emphasis to what John said, is that at bottom there is a cultural clash that the people who are following this field need to be aware of. The deal lawyers who mostly construct these deals believe there is no set of considerations that can't be addressed by structuring the deal properly, and often no set of legal restrictions that can't be addressed by properly structuring the deal. And CFIUS, as a creature of Washington, has great respect for how clever those deal lawyers can be, and also is determined to make sure that no matter how clever they are, CFIUS can always reach a transaction it wants to reach. And so if CFIUS ever feels that it is getting structuring rather than deference to its judgments when it's dealing with parties, as soon as they feel that, they begin to ratchet down their control of the transaction. And that could have happened here. They may have felt that the effort to repatriate Broadcom on an accelerated basis was an attempt to defeat CFIUS's jurisdiction, and they were absolutely determined that no one would use matters of form to defeat CFIUS's jurisdiction once it had taken control of the case.
And Dean, may I also add that there's a misconception out there that, you know, the CFIUS recommends yay, nay, and then the president decides yay or nay. And that's really a little simplistic. First of all, the president does not have to follow the CFIUS recommendation. He can do whatever he wants. And number two, it isn't just a yes, no answer. A fairly recent example is in 2006 under 43's administration. Alcatel, which is a French company, they wanted to buy Lucent Technologies, and it came under CFIUS review. Now, President Bush approved it, but it was a conditional approval. In other words, number one, Alcatel had to agree to what's known as a special security arrangement, and they agreed that Alcatel agreed that it would not have full access to the sensitive work of Bell Labs, which was Lucent's recent research division. It also agreed that it would not have access to the U.S. communications infrastructure. And last but not least, Alcatel agreed that CFIUS could reopen the review anytime it felt like if it believed that the combined company materially failed to comply with any aspect of the special security arrangement. So that's the president has an enormous discretion, enormous power, and it isn't just limited to a yes-no decision.
We do have one caller who's been waiting with a question for quite a while. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's now check in with that very patient caller.
This is Ron Castellanos. A question about the process, the administrative law side of it. Is the CFIUS essentially an agency under the APA, or is it just an advisory board to the president whose decision is unreviewable?
I would have said that it's the president who is the agency in question here. I think that position may be gradually undercut by CFIUS's growing institutionalization and authority to take action on its own without sending that decision through to the White House for ratification. But as a practical matter, it moves fast enough that it might be hard to get review of anything other than the final decision.
Well, the question is really a question of law. Is CFIUS an agency under the APA? And if not, I understand your answer. But if it is, then there's a process and the record decision has to be on the record and potential challenges under the APA might come about. But it sounds like it's not. Is that true?
That's been my understanding, and that's how I believe the Rawls case played out. It was a challenge to the president's action on due process grounds, and there are very limited the judicial review here is very limited to the point of not existing at all. So it may be that. What we usually think of as APA review is simply not available because of the statutory restrictions on review, which may be why the Rawls court went to a due process constitutional analysis.
So the same is true for notice and comment or anything about the submissions by the parties. None of those submissions are available to the public? Is that
right? So there are regulations. I'm sure they went through notice and comment. They're issued by the Treasury. I know they went through notice and comment. But the individual decisions, as far as I know, have not been subject to challenge.
Interesting.
Well, once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open if you have a question. This is Dean Reuter again, of course, but I feel like I see some daylight between your two positions on the question of CFIUS jurisdiction. And I think I've heard John Hsu argue that domicility is not per se definitive. That is, even if in this instance Broadcom had changed its domicile, CFIUS would have retained jurisdiction. I thought I heard otherwise from Stuart Baker that indeed CFIUS acted quickly because Broadcom had made some noise or taken some actions about changing its domicile, and there was concern that CFIUS would lose its jurisdiction. So we
may be closer than you think. I think we would both agree that domicile by itself doesn't determine whether this is a foreign purchaser or not. U.S. subsidiary of a foreign company is domiciled here, but would be treated as a foreign purchaser. What was unusual about Broadcom was that it had been a U.S. company. It had a lot of U.S. shareholders, was a publicly held company. As a practical matter, it looked, but for domicile, a lot like Qualcomm. Lots of U.S. managers, lots of U.S. Shareholders. And so domicile was more important in that context than it would be if there were other indicia of foreign control.
And again, you know, that's why when CFIUS examines a deal, it doesn't just look at the entities, the primary entities. It looks at any kind of side agreement. It looks at any kind of partnership agreement, looks at subsidiaries, investors, even individual investors. You know, for example, if there's two entities that are merging and both are domiciled in the United States, but for one of those entities, the primary investor is an individual who's a bad actor in hiding in some unknown jurisdiction, I think CFIUS would be pretty upset about that. And I think that's reasonable.
Yes, the notion of control, acquisition of control by a foreign person, is also stretched pretty far. You know, a 15% interest will be treated as control for purposes of granting CFIUS jurisdiction over a particular transaction. Again, to make sure that CFIUS can take account of unusual cases where the control is exercised in unusual ways. I think we had a transaction where 3Com was going to be sold in large part to Bain, which is a U.S. company, but there were a variety of Chinese companies that were going to have minority interests, plus they were supplying many of 3Com's components, and they were buying a large chunk of what 3Com manufactured. And CFIUS ultimately said the combination of shareholding plus supplier plus customer relationships constitutes control by a foreign company, and we're going to review and indeed reject the transaction.
Let me make another call for questions. We've got almost 20 minutes left. Push the star button and the pound button if you have a question. I will carry on with a question or two. We've heard a lot about how powerful the president is and the fact that CFIUS itself can sort of reach out, I guess, sua sponte and review a proposed deal. My question goes to the president's authority to act unilaterally, and this is, of course, hypothetical. If CFIUS passes on something, doesn't say yes or no, but just didn't even review a proposed transaction, does the president have the authority to block it?
So the assumption has always been that the president, as commander-in-chief, has considerable national security authority, and if he invokes national security and says this transaction has damaged national security and has to be undone, that he could do it. And it's the fear that he might do that in unanticipated circumstances that for a long time drove the voluntary submissions under CFIUS, because the assumption was that the CFIUS process allowed those considerations to be considered, and if the president approved a transaction after CFIUS review, you could be reasonably confident that you would not have a dead-of-the-night national security determination from the president. To my knowledge, that's never happened. Usually there are enough security hawks to get any transaction that the president wants to see to his desk. And so you can be reasonably sure that CFIUS will bring transactions the president wants to see to the White House so that he can take the action that he wants to take.
I
agree with.
Go ahead, John Chu. Go ahead.
I was just going to say I agree with Stuart, and also I would also add that what happens sometimes is that the local congressman who is, you know, might be his district might be affected one way or the other. Local congressmen will often make a stink about it, either in the public press, or he may, you know, send a letter directly to the Secretary of the Treasury. And I say the Secretary of the Treasury because he is the one who's chairman of the CFIUS committee. And usually what happens then is that he sends the letter and then he leaks it. So that's that's very common, and it's, you know, and part of the reason we have the CFIUS now is so that the president doesn't have to. He's not in the position where he has to all by himself unilaterally, you know, make a decision without some sort of bureaucratic coverage. And if we did not have a CFIUS, I mean, it would probably run through Treasury or Homeland Security or Department of Defense. And as a matter of fact, there have been suggestions in the past that the chairman of CFIUS be the Secretary of Defense instead of the Secretary of the Treasury. Some people more recently have suggested that it should be the Secretary of Commerce because of all the intellectual property issues involved. But because at its core, it's deal-making, I believe that it's appropriate for the Secretary of the Treasury to chair CFIUS, and I believe that will continue to be for quite some time.
And I take it, given back to my hypothetical about the president, a president acting without CFIUS having acted, it is the action of CFIUS that insulates the ultimate decision from judicial review. Is that correct? In other words, if a president acted unilaterally, that might be subject to judicial review, or.
Yes, I think you'd at least have the steel seizure review process available. You're quite right.
Interesting. John Chiu, did you have something else?
Well, I would also add that, and I think Stuart is correct, that the Youngstown steel seizure case, you know, is always in the background when you exercise presidential power in this way. But the legislation or the proposed legislation that I had mentioned before that Senator Cornyn and Senator Feinstein are co-sponsoring, that actually expands CFIUS power in many ways. And it also expands the definition of critical technologies. The statute as it is, it talks about critical infrastructure, because in 88, nobody could picture an iPhone. But now it's, you know, the issue that's involved, critical technologies, is very, very important. And in some ways, I would say more important than steel, which is what the Japanese were concerned about in the 80s. So, and it also gives CFIUS a power to exempt certain transactions if a certain list of criteria are met. So the movement is towards actually expanding CFIUS power and CFIUS authority. And I would say that the more it gets expanded, if this legislation ever goes through, it's not really a priority right now, but the more it's expanded, I think the less judicial review is going to be available, especially because as it is, it's absolutely minimal, the chances for judicial review. I think courts are loath to touch anything involving national security if they don't have to.
I would second the idea that the spirit of the times favors an expansion of CFIUS because of the concerns about the military and economic challenge that the Chinese present. And if for those who are following this on policy grounds, there are two steps that are likely to come about. I actually think that Senator Cornyn's bill has a fighting chance to become law. It's got backing from the Trump administration. He's done a good job of making it a bipartisan proposal, and he has accommodated criticism without gutting his bill, so that I think there's a real possibility that it will pass, although, you know, you can usually make money in Washington betting legislation won't pass. So we'll have to see. But more certain is that there will be new restrictions on at least Chinese investment adopted as part of the president's response to what he would describe as Chinese cheating on international trade. You remember that he announced last week that he was planning $60 billion in tariffs on Chinese goods. Less attention was paid to the fact that he also ordered the Secretary of Treasury to come up with limits on Chinese investments as a further punitive effort. And that set of limits is likely to resemble CFIUS in many respects.
And we are here because of the huge amount of what we refer to as FDI, foreign direct investment, by the Chinese. And it isn't just a Chinese issue. Like, for example, instead of China, if it was Russia, or Saudi or Nigeria that was dumping in billions of dollars in foreign direct investment, the same issues would exist. So it's not just focused on China because people don't like Chinese people. It's not like that. And I would also say, what's interesting to me is that in the 80s, it wasn't just Japanese steel, but a Japanese company wanted to buy Fairchild Semiconductor, and CFIUS stepped in and stopped that transaction. And here we are 30 years later, where, again, we're dealing with semiconductor transactions, just a different country. And so, you know, Vanilla Ice may not be cool anymore, or scrunchies, but national security still is very important. And I think we need to continue focusing on that as the technologies and as the world becomes more financially interconnected. President Trump also stopped a MoneyGram deal. That wasn't semiconductors, but that nobody wants the Chinese government to have direct access to the treasury and the banking system. So that was kind of a no-brainer. But that did not raise, you know, the same controversies that this Broadcom deal did. And maybe it was because of the size. The Broadcom deal was huge. It was valued somewhere between $117 to $140-some billion. But CFIUS, there's no minimum or maximum size for CFIUS. CFIUS can step in regardless of the size of the deal.
Well, I am out of questions. It looks like our audience is out of questions as well. I'm going to give each of you, in the order we began, a chance to wrap up or express a final thought. With that, Stuart Baker, final thought?
Sure. I think CFIUS we will always have with us. As we've seen, it serves many purposes, and we are in a stage of redefining our relationship with the global economy and with the Chinese economy. My last word on this would be a bit of pleading on behalf of President Trump, who, as usual, is getting terrible press for every decision he makes. And as John said, he's been accused of doing things that no president has ever done. I think in this, as in so many other areas of policy, it's not hard to predict President Trump's views. If you ask what Walter Reuther, the head of the UAW in the 1970s, would have thought about an issue, it's almost certain to be what President Trump thinks about it as well. And Reuther was enthusiastic about it was deeply skeptical about the impact of foreign trade and aggressive about protecting against investments from foreign parts that might undermine American national security. So this is a mainstream Democratic position from the 70s, retread by President Trump, as in so many other areas. You can disagree with it, but you can hardly say it's unprecedented.
Final thought from John Chu.
Just that CFIUS is and its actions are, you know, completely bipartisan in the sense that both Democrat and Republican presidents have used it to stop or approve certain transactions. Number two, a lot of the reporting in the mainstream press has not been accurate, or certainly not legally accurate. And then most important for the practitioners out there, you know, if you yourself have to investigate beyond who the entities are to make sure that there aren't any other side parties or hidden parties that could affect the deal, and you should treat CFIUS or CFIUS action, potential action, as you would treat any other routine action, whether it's Hart-Scott-Rodino or an SEC review or whatever. This is not something that a practitioner can just ignore.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you on behalf of the Federalist Society. Again, Stuart Baker, author of the five-star award-winning book, Skating on Stilts, and John Hsu, attorney and legal commenter. I also want to thank our audience for dialing in, and thank you for your thoughtful questions. Or a reminder to our audience about our next scheduled teleforum conference call. That's tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern time at this same number. We'll be discussing an important Second Circuit case that might well be headed to the Supreme Court. Cert is pending. That concerns the jurisdiction of U.S. courts, and it's a case brought by victims of terrorism against the Palestinian Liberation Organization. That's tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern time. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.